Good morning, everyone. So we're here. We're at the end of the retreat, and there may be all different kind of emotions and feelings coming up for everybody. I'm sure there's a wide range of everything. So just being mindful for what's coming up for us. And George did a wonderful job last night of just kind of opening up how to bring this practice home. So I know there were many things in what he said that will help us in our journey back into reality. And I was just going to share a little bit more about my practice and how I bring this practice home. So there was, I think Joseph had said, when I look at my whole range of where I started 20 years ago with the practice, and when I look at my life here, it has not been a straight path. There's been a journey of more and more inner discovery and just getting to know my mind and my body more, my connection with other beings more, connection with my heart more. But it hasn't been like a steady, you know, rise. Like we want everything in life to be perfect and okay, we're on this path and it's going to go from A to B to C to, you know, the way a linear type of path. It hasn't been that at all. It's been more like a river with different flows and, you know, sometimes going off course, hitting the bank of the river, coming back into the flow of the river and, you know, grabbing onto a stick and not letting, you know, so it's been all kind of different movements on this river of life and this path of awakening. So it has not always been easy, and it won't be for any of us. You know, life is real. You know, sometimes I laugh when, you know, there's this thing, oh, just be happy, just be happy. But hello, if you don't know what the other side of happiness is, then how can you be happy all the time? It's impossible. We know everything's impermanent. So sometimes I just look back and I say, okay, this path has really helped me to be with life as it is, you know, that there will be ups and downs, that I have a practice that can help me meet everything that happens in my life. And that's, I'm so grateful for that aspect of this practice, because it really has given me the gift of knowing that within this heart and mind that I have the ability to meet whatever happens. You know, and that's such a powerful thing. And it's to meet, like, to the end, to the last dying breath. You know, I have this practice to meet each thing as it comes. And then it's also given me ability to be alive in each moment. Because so much of the time we're lost in this fog of the past, of the future, of not connecting right in the present. And the present is all that's really happening. There's nothing else. It's right here, right now. What's coming in through these sense doors, that's it. All the illusions of the past and the present are not real. So I'm not connecting with the beauty of this moment to sit in this room, you know, with all these beautiful beings that are on this path of awakening, of trying to discover more about our minds and bodies, the inner journey. I'm not appreciating these teachers that have given from the heart, you know, so many beautiful lessons and teachings, and, you know, not for gain of money or fame. You know, they're doing it from their heart. It's not, definitely not for money, that I know. So, you know, just to feel that, you know, it's like a sense of so much gratitude. You know, my heart is so full to know that IMS is here and is striving and giving us so much. We were fed. We had heat, we had hot water, we had everything that all of our needs were taken care of. Oh, my heart is so full with that. So just taking that in, just being here in that moment, that's what the practice has given me. I'm not lost in, oh, I'm going home, or, you know, something happened 10 years ago, whatever. I'm here, I'm present, and I can get lost again. You know, my mind could go again into the dream of whatever, but then I'm back. Okay, I'm breathing. I'm taking this step. I'm here present. So much gratitude. So the practice has given me so many beautiful things in my life, you know, and then to take it back home is just the continuity of that. You know, how can we bring that presence into our life so that we don't get caught up in these habit patterns of disconnecting? Because really all we're looking for is connection. That's all we're really looking for in this life, is how to connect with each other, with the bird, with the breeze. We're always looking to connect. So how do we keep connected instead of disconnecting and taking detours and, looking at the cell phone for 3 hours, or, turning the computer, and that's okay, but coming back, awakening to, wait a second, I've been with this, looking at this phone for 2 hours now, I need to put it down, my shoulders are tight, my mind is all knotted up, my heart is constricted, there's nothing flowing here, let me put this down and connect again with life, so it's always touching in, and for me, a big part of the practice is the body awareness, because sometimes we're just lost in the flow of life and our jobs, our families, our friends, whatever's coming up. So for me, the body is really important because it tells me, I can feel when something is off because I could feel the tightness. I feel the constriction, I feel the shoulders, my breath gets short, and even before I could even mentally make a note of what's going on, my body's already telling me something is up here, and I need to stop and look at what it is. So it could be at work, it just could be that the flow of work is so intense and things are coming at me from different ways and I'm feeling the tightness and the constriction. Okay, stop, not go ahead, take a breath, just stop, even if for that moment, just to reconnect. Okay, why am I here? I'm here to serve. I'm here to open my heart. And just land in the moment again. Oh, such a relief. Such a blessing to have a practice that you could just stop in that moment, take a breath, reconnect, to our aspiration of being present. So it's just a, like I said, for me, it's a blessing. This path has been a blessing in many ways. So I start my day, most days I start with my practice of sitting. Why? Because sitting reconnects me again to that aspiration of connection, of connecting into the inner landscape of what's going on. So sometimes it's hard to sit because our minds are so agitated and active or whatever. Usually for me, the morning is the best time because it's quiet. And so I make time in the morning to sit. Sometimes I like to sit for an hour. Sometimes I sit for 5 minutes. If I have to be at work at 6 o'clock in the morning, I may have to shorten my sit. If I'm off for the day, I like to sit an hour is usually what I like to sit. But everybody's different. Everybody could find time in their life to make, because it just reconnects again to the stillness, to the silence, to listening within. Because sometimes if we're busy in life, we're not really noticing what's going on. What kind of patterns are we holding on to? What kind of whatever, that life brings us, which is so much. When we sit down, we could sit with it and see, okay, this is what's happening right now. This is how it is right now. And just reconnecting to the silence and to the mindfulness, because the practice of mindfulness is really what takes us through life. The continuity of mindfulness is so important. Sometimes you think of mindfulness, oh, I got to be noting. You're not on retreat. When you're out in life, it's a gentle mindfulness. You're just aware. Like for me, I have a body. So I kind of just subtly stay in my body during the day doing whatever I have to do. And that keeps me grounded. Just knowing, I'm sitting there. It's not like a noting hard that, oh, there's a body, a heart pounding, sensations in my arm. No, it's just, there is a body. So I'm just there in that body, and that really, it grounds me so that I'm more grounded during the day. So sitting again helps me allow to ground back into, okay, let me see how I'm going to start my day here. What are my aspirations? Let me ground in my body, my breath, and I may get lost, as we all get lost in the day, and I come back. I like when George says, you're in the eye of the whirlwind. So our practice kind of gives us that stability of being in the eye of the storm. And then when we go out in the world, we can be taken out and the storm starts to pull our hair and we start to go, let me come back into the eye of the storm, back grounding to the moment, to my breath, to the body. So we have our anchor. That's what we've been developing during this week, is working with that anchor, because it's always there. It's a nice thing about this practice. You don't have to reach for a book. You don't have to worry about finding the guru, nothing. It's right here. Your breath and your body is it. And you come, I'm back again. I'm home, and you're back. So I start with the sitting practice. I do yoga. Usually for me, yoga is nice. So I stretch after I sit. And then I feel like for the day, I have kind of a really nice way to start the day. My heart feels good. No, I've looked at certain things. There may be still some agitation about certain things, but I've been honest about where I am, and I can say, okay, with wisdom and with clarity, now I could decide how I want to move forward in this day, which is what our practice gives us, that wisdom and clarity when we can sit with whatever it is in that moment. We start to, when I'm sitting, I'm connecting again to the wonder, the mystery of life, the sacredness of life. Again, I'm reconnecting to that, because we're so easily taken out of that aspiration and that center. I connect with the heart, you know, with metta, coming back to the heart. And a lot of times for me, reconnecting, I know exactly with, especially relationships, of course, are a big edge of the practice. So for me, I can tell when I'm getting too much heady and too much, because I feel so disconnected for that person. I'm so much in my mind and my own judgments and my own thoughts, and I feel the disconnection happening. I just drop down into my heart. I say, okay, I feel all of that happening, and I feel the disconnection from that person, and I just drop down to my heart. I'm even making sounds like Joseph. This is not good. But anyway, I love that sound he makes, because it is, it's true that you just come back down to your heart, you know, and then I'm there. I said, okay, how can I be more gentle with this? How can I be softened to this experience? How can I soften my relationship with this person? And it's not about me. It's not about me, my I. It's about how can I create more peace in this situation? You know, even if I have to let go of this I that wants to be right, that wants to be correct, you know, all of that stuff that comes with the I. So the heart is what lets the softening happen. So that has been a great, and I've seen that little by little as the years go by. It just, you know, it gets softer and easier when you can land in that heart kind of sense of connection, of interbeing. It's so much, and I just had 15 minutes, but let me see what else. You can pick something to work on, like Joseph was talking about generosities. I work a lot with patience, so I kind of like make patience my mantra. So whenever, well, where do you work with patience? In the midst of impatience. So, I mean, that comes up so much for me. So I'm in the middle of traffic, or I'm waiting on a grocery line or wherever it is, and all of a sudden I feel the tightness, the constriction, the separation. Oh, I'm impatient. You know, I'm leaning forward into this next moment, into whatever. So, okay, patience. Let me come back to this moment, relax, breathe. Okay, this is going to take an hour to get through this line. Okay, this is it. You know, whatever it is, the patience. So I've made patience really something that I have been working with for a little bit of time here. And you could take anything. It could be generosity, you know, the tightness of the freedom of giving and the tightness of not giving. And the generosity is not necessarily money. It could be a smile, could be, you know, any act of kindness. It could be helping your elderly neighbor with groceries or taking them to the clinic, or, you know, it could be anything. You know, just gentle acts of kindness and generosity, could be your practice. And that alone can start to open up your heart. So there's different ways of working with opening the compassion and the metta and the heart qualities by doing for other people, getting out of the me, my, and I. And I'm just about finished. But the other thing that I will say is that for me, I really hold impermanence is really like the background of where I land, because the impermanence allows me to really be present, knowing that the next breath is not guaranteed, knowing that the next moment is a mystery, that I really don't know what's going to happen in life, and knowing that everything is, that I may never see you again, you know, just looking in your eyes and knowing that. So there's something about just letting the teachings of impermanence permeate every cell in my being and allow me to move into this world. It just gives a greater appreciation for everything, and a greater gratitude, and it's a wonderful teaching, impermanence, and just letting it really become a part of our lives, you know, because nothing is guaranteed. We don't know when our next breath is coming, if it's coming. So just sitting back in that is amazing. You know, it's just a wonderful way of living and holding life. So we're going to open up to questions now. And the questions could be directed to any of us, and it could be any questions about going back into your life, any questions that we had about the anything. So we'll open up the floor to questions. Yes.
Okay. It'll be the same answer.
Who's going to take it? Jill?
I'm not sure if it'll be the same answer, but I actually use breath counting quite a lot. Especially, more so in daily life, actually, than on retreat, because in daily life, with all the extra stimulation, it's often harder to get some degree of stability of mind, so I will often do that, and I tend to count in sets of 10, just to have it be a bit more, help me stay connected more. So like you count bars of music, I count 1 through 10, and then 1, 1, 2, 1, 3, and so on, 2, 1, 2, 2, 2, 3. And I find that easier to maintain a momentum with, and to get some degree of stability of mind. In, out, one, but it really doesn't matter. You know, all of these are skillful means that you can just play with and see what helps you to develop some stability, even with all that everything else that's going on.
Yeah. I would just add one thing to that. As you're doing the counting, if and when you do, just pay attention to which is louder, the number or the actual feeling of the breath. Because sometimes people get so caught in the counting that the numbers become what we're focusing on, rather than really a very soft background that's connecting us primarily to what we're actually feeling with the breath. So just keep in mind that foreground-background balance.
I staying on topic for a moment. It's probably one of the most frequent instructions to focus on the breath, and then soon enough you'll be distracted by thought or some other phenomena. And I'm assuming you all, and perhaps Joseph, since his practice has been the longest, so perhaps this is addressed to you. At some point, perhaps in our journey, we'll be able to stay on the breath for longer periods. Let's say you stay on the breath, focus, because you have developed concentration for the whole sit. What is that like?
Here's where I levitate. You know what it's like because just from your experience of being having a stable mindfulness and concentration for however long, even if it's for 1 minute or 2 minutes or 3 minutes, during that time you have the experience of being present and being connected. So just extrapolate that. So it's the same experience, only longer, and it can get more stable at times. But I want to disabuse you of the idea that the point of practice is to be able to stay with the breath for an hour. That's not what this is about. It's about being mindful of whatever arises. And so a more accurate gauge of how strong the mindfulness is, or you know, seeing it develop, is not necessarily how long you can stay with the breath, but how quickly you become aware of thoughts arising in the mind. So even if they keep coming, or come intermittently but frequently, if we can be aware of the thought closer to the beginning rather than after 5 or 10 minutes, so then the mindfulness is as strong with the breath as an object, as it is with the thought as an object, as it is with the breath. So it gets very problematic if you create a model of what your experience should be, you know, as the practice develops. Really, the only model that I found really helpful is, in any moment, are we mindful of what's arising? And it's only one of six things that are arising. Are we mindful in that moment or not? And it can be any of those objects. And so working with the breath and concentration is a valuable thing to do as a foundation for that moment-to-moment awareness. Yeah, I think if it's from... Did everybody hear the question?
No.
Who would like to answer?
Someone
needs
to
repeat it.
Okay.
The question was around vegetarianism and the value of it. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, or, well, you know, is it just that it's traditionally, you know, sort of where Buddhism originated and that's mm-hmm. the idea?
I don't believe that it is a Buddhist. There are Buddhists that eat meat. Depends on your values and how you want to hold it. Different people hold it as a value that they want to live in completely vegetarian, and then there's lacto-vegetarian, so there's different degrees of that. There's also the aspect of non-harming. So one of the precepts is not killing. So if you're directly killing something to eat it, we don't encourage that at all. That's breaking the precept. But then there's degrees of that, so it depends on that spectrum, what your values are and, you know, how you hold it. There are Buddhists that are not vegetarians, and then there are many Buddhists that are, so it's a wide range of how you hold that. I don't know if you want to add anything. Yes? Oh, I'm sorry. Wait, I'm okay. Go ahead first and then. Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, thank you so much. My question is about kind of, in addition to practice outside, like practice in daily life, also returning to retreat life. And I'm interested in kind of continuing to deepen my practice in possibly doing like a longer retreat. Or here is the 3-month retreat the longest. So I'm curious about your recommendations for kind of how to go about that, and if there's kind of a sort of direction to go.
Well, for me, I feel that one informs the other. So I've learned that the retreat practice is so valuable because it gives me that space to deepen my practice, and then it informs my life. So there's kind of, for me, there's a flow of a balance with doing retreats and then going out into the world and working with the tools that I've been given, the skills that I've been given. So there's a balance. And for me, there's certain times when I just need to pull back and do retreat. And I have the luxury and the time and the privilege to do that, you know, respecting that. And then there's times when I can't. I have to work and make a living, and I have to use my life as a practice. So I have to balance that, all of that out. But for me personally, retreats, long retreats, have helped my practice grow immensely. But I can't say that for everybody. You know, but for personally, for me, so kind of like we have to check in and see what's needed. Anybody?
Yeah. I'll just add something to that. As you know, for the conditions to come together that provide an opportunity to do practice, whether it's a 9-day retreat or a 3-month retreat, or there have been people who've come to the forest refuge and spent a year in practice or more, So the length of time can really vary. I would say that when there is an interest, you know, and there's a strong motivation and an opportunity, go for it. Because you don't know how when those conditions will come together again. And it's kind of rare in one's life, you know, to take an extended period of time to devote to practice, you know, as we're living as lay people in the world. So when the conditions are there and the interest is there, it's a great thing to do. But as Nakawe said, and as you know very well now, it's a great thing to do, but it's not a bliss trip. Yeah, there'll be lots of ups and downs that is, as you explore the whole totality of your experience. But that opportunity to do so is so precious, you know, that you know, when there's a possibility and there's an interest, I would definitely encourage it.
I'd just like to add a little to that. Having seen in my own experience and many people, they get inspired, they come on retreat, the flow of daily life goes on, and 2 years, 5 years later, oh, I should do a retreat. So I often encourage people to take a more strategic approach and actually write themselves a curriculum to be thinking in terms of 2 years, 5 years, and beyond. So if you've done a 9-day retreat, maybe you look for a 2-week retreat. If you've done a 2-week retreat, you might be working towards a 3-month. So most retreats you need to book a long way in advance, and obviously time off work and everything. So to be thinking towards those, to also to help maintain motivation in the practice, can be really helpful. And in a similar way, I think of the Noble Eightfold Path as being a curriculum. So 3 of those factors are to do with meditation, but there's also the daily life factors of wise action, wise speech, and so on, wise livelihood. So we can think strategically in terms of when are we working the daily life practice, when is it time to do more silent retreats, and also study. So having a balance between those 3 arenas can be very useful.
So just to add to that, when I first started practicing and I got inspired like you did, and I thought I had to go to Tibet to really practice or become a monk, and talking to my teachers, I came to the realization that I didn't have to do that. I could do that here. So for several years, I used to just come up here and do weekend retreats. And then at CIMC, I would do day-long retreats. And then there was a period of time I didn't work for 2 years, so I did 3-month retreat and a half of a 3-month retreat back-to-back. And so I went from sitting all the time, living in a meditation center for 6 years, and just living in the space and being on the board here, I did a tremendous amount of sitting. And then I went from sitting all the time and doing deep practice to going back to work and being in the world. And Joseph was really helpful with me saying, okay, now you're in work mode. And so I continued to practice. And like Nakawe said, you find a rhythm and you'll figure it out. But when you can sit, like when I had those 2 years where I didn't work by choice, I had a lot of time to sit, 14 days, and I lived at the meditation center in Cambridge, so I could participate in all the classes, and I was on the board here, so I could come here and sit. I could go to the study center and sit, the forest refuge. So it depends on your situation. If you, as Joseph said, if you had the opportunity to sit, then take advantage of it, because your life gets busy. And I've talked to folks who, when you have kids, it's kind of challenging.
Jerry?
Bob. I was invited by a good friend who just became a grandmother to a Lincoln Center tomorrow night to hear the Chamber Society. And I'm finding myself fearful, and I want to keep this feeling. I want to stay mindful, and I'm worried about being in the crowd. The
It's a great question. I would say, be mindful of the fearful anticipation now. You know, so instead of trying to project yourself into tomorrow night and what it's going to be like, and then whether you should go or you shouldn't go, right now is the feeling of some fearfulness or anxiety or confusion or wondering. So if you're mindful of this state now and not getting caught up in it, not being identified with it, but just realizing out of conditions, these mind states are arising, fear, anxiety, wondering, whatever it is, then you can simply keep your practice going in terms of being mindful moment to moment as things present itself. And I think of all the worldly things you might be engaged in, that seems rather a nice way of re-entering the world, going to a concert of chamber music.
I'm projecting forward right now.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's only a problem if you are identified with it and carried away by it. Yeah.
So we've all heard the teachings many times that often in the initial stages of practice, quote initial stages, which I understand could last decades or lifetimes, the insights tend to be personal and psychological, and that at some point they become more universal insights. So my experience after 60 gabillion retreats is that my insights tend to still be all in the psychological realm, the personal realm. I haven't had experiences of the three characteristics and so on. And they tend to be insights of things like not good enough, or you know, the inner critic mind, and seeing that more deeply and more clearly. And I think that as a result of that, I've become, over the years, more self-accepting and so on. But like, when am I going to start to experience the... All right, let me word it differently. Could you describe that process whereby the universal insight... I mean, I would really like to experience impermanence rather than, yeah, yeah, not good enough, yeah, yeah, not for the 40 billionth time. You get my drift?
The standard answer that I used to give it when I started teaching, I used to hear it from teaching, and I would respond to you with more sitting is required. Okay, that's what I'm. But I'd say be sensitive about trying to figure out what it's going to be, or as I like to say, if you're focused on how you're doing and not focused on what you're doing, it makes a difference. So it's okay to see that, yeah, you want to experience impermanence or not self or suffering. I would say the suffering one shouldn't be foreign to you. Okay, so but you see, even so you're looking at it like you haven't done any of them, but you have. And so you might want to check out, well, what mind is observing and having that opinion of what's happening. And it could be, you know, I'm doing this, but I'm not doing it right, or I don't know if I'm making, or I'm not making as much progress as I would, that I have expected, or that I want to make. And sometimes what we find is, because you're perceiving with a preconceived notion, and you're not really able to see what's already right and what is helpful, and that. Sometimes success is the progressive realization of a worthy goal. So it's progress, not perfection. And to start to look at it. So maybe the impermanence thing, you haven't gotten it because you think that you're going to arrive and you're going to see everything is impermanent, instead of having moments when you experience impermanence. And then when we start to look at them and see them more often, then they'll grow in your experience. And then you realize that like I've been realizing even on this retreat, I'm making this way too complicated. And the insights will just come if I just be still and know it. Just look without trying to see anything in particular. But just by observing, like Yogi Berra said, you can see a lot just by observing. Right? And that's it. And just getting a little tinge of knowing what suffering is, knowing when you can let go and there's no suffering. Maybe that's enough for now.
I just want to add a little bit to what George said. Sometimes we have ideas in our mind about what the experience of these characteristics will be like. Like, oh, when I'm seeing impermanence, and then you have some idea of what that's going to be.
Right. I do have an idea. My idea is like when I hear the birds tweet, 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 that I'll be like, oh, that I'll experience the impermanence. Well, seriously, that I'll experience the impermanence in the tweet.
Okay, this is a great example. So the idea is that in hearing the bird go, you know, tweet, 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 that then they'll be, oh, I'm experiencing impermanence. How about if you just leave off the part, oh, now I'm experiencing impermanence, because you have already experienced the impermanence. You've heard the sound come and go. So this is really following just on what George said. The insight into impermanence is not some esoteric experience. You take a step, and there's the beginning and the movement, and you're touching the ground. When your foot is touching the ground, what has happened to the movement of the lifting of the heel? It's gone. You know, they lift the heel, gone. Moving forward, gone. Touching the ground, gone. So in every step you can be experiencing impermanence. Not only in every step, in everything, because things are changing. It's just I think you have an idea of what this insight is going to be like, the big... I would focus on seeing the impermanence of that expectation. And then you will settle into the experience of change, because it's all the time in the most ordinary aspects of our lives. It's not necessarily some big wow.
In the back? Mm-hmm. Frances, yeah.
Thank you. Can you talk a little bit about joy and it's that sort of awe? George talked a little bit about wonder and how that's, I think, tied to curiosity. But I feel sometimes we walk around feeling as though we have to keep that backpack of grim duty or unworthiness on. And in some ways, we miss the magic of that joy that we can maybe tap into. And I guess, I don't know, I guess to balance out the fact that, like you say, there's both. And it's not just one thing that we're looking for or looking at.
Are you asking me or you're just asking the question? You're asking anybody, right?
You, anybody can answer.
See, I want to make sure. Remember I talked about inclusion last night? Everybody is. How's it say? Just saying.
That's teamwork, right?
That's teamwork.
Knowing when to pass the buck. So, yeah, that's one reason why I like to teach all four of the Brahmaviharas, because they very directly bring in this capacity for joy. And in my own experience and working with a lot of students, you know, as I've touched into a few times, we tend to have this default tendency towards what's wrong, what needs improving, and so on. And then by extension, our practice becomes a big self-improvement project, a duty, a chore, just another thing to check off on our to-do list. So the invitation is to constantly be looking at, well, what's the attitude in the mind to experience, not only on the small scale, but on the bigger picture. Am I becoming dry or tight or rigid or disconnected, and how do I refresh the energy, the awe, the joy, the wonder, and so on? Because we can hear teachings on the Four Noble Truths and hear a lot about suffering, and because of our negativity bias, unconsciously think, oh, this is all about suffering. And because many of us have a Judeo-Christian heritage where it's somehow supposed to be hard and painful and challenging, and if it's not, I'm doing something wrong. I'm not practicing deeply enough or doing it hard enough or, you know, giving it its full intensity. So again, that's why I emphasize this attitude of getting used to it, because for many of us, what we're getting used to are more skillful states, like calm and ease and joy and wonder and so on. So from my perspective, it's never too early to start inclining the heart and the mind in that direction and familiarizing ourselves with these skillful states. That's really the arc of the whole of this training. Is that in the terrain?
Yeah, for sure. And I guess I'm really appreciating the fact that you're bringing that in again, because there's just a part of me that wants there to be a real opportunity for that shared joy, that appreciative joy that Devin talked about, that it can grow. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
We just have time for one or two more. Okay, fine. Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, great. Okay. I was just like wondering, like here, I could practice mindfulness, and it's like a nice space, it's easier, and even though it's nice, I still feel these things, it's kind of uncomfortable that I was saying to you before, like, sometimes it feels more pleasant just to be lost in a nice thought, but then of course mindfulness helps with like life in general, right? So you practice it, but then I'm wondering, like, my place where I live right now at home is so uncomfortable that it's like I come back after a full day, I'm already tired, and now I'm gonna, like, it's so hard to stay mindful because there's so much uncomfortable emotion, there's someone who I'm living with who's so mean, just being there, I feel like shit. So it's like easy to like throw my phone, watch some Avatar or something, watching Dragon Ball Z, but like, I don't know, what do I do? Like, it's just so much, like, so unpleasant to be mindful of, like, the situation, because it's so uncomfortable. What do I do in that situation? Like, I don't know, like, because if I could like be somewhere else, like here, and then go there for like an hour a day, you know, that'd be easier. But I'm living there all the time, you know. So, that's my question for anyone.
Well, if you start a meditation center, then you can just live there. So I think there are two components in what you're. Could you hear that in the back? So the comment was that many that some of the circumstances of his living situation are unpleasant and it's stressful, and so being mindful of it just seems to bring up more dukkha. Yeah. And the tendency in the mind, let me just space out, let me distract myself so I don't have to be with this. So I think there are two aspects to this. A big part of the practice, which we've been cultivating here, is the practice of equanimity. And equanimity means that non-reactivity of mind to both pleasant and unpleasant. You know, realizing that in our life conditions, it's going to be a flow between these two poles, sometimes pleasant, sometimes unpleasant. Generally, as we've talked about and as you know very well, there's such hard wiring for I want what's pleasant, I don't want what's unpleasant. So this is a deeply established pattern in almost everybody. But the practice of equanimity, which comes through mindfulness, in a very gradual way expands our capacity to hold the unpleasant without reaction. So I'll just give you one example. I mentioned this to somebody in an interview. In my years when I was practicing in India, and I'd been there for some time, and the practice had gotten really quite steady and deep, and I would be sitting for long hours at a time, mind very concentrated. And then Munindra, my first teacher, who was, I mean, he's a very great teacher, but very quirky. Every Western traveler that came to Bodh Gaya, which is where I was living, he said, oh, let's go meet Joseph. So I'm just sitting in my room, you know, in this really quiet, still space. And this person, not interested in meditation particularly, just was a little chit-chat. So at first I was really annoyed, you know. Here I'm on the verge of enlightenment. You know. And my teacher is coming and... So I would get up and I would talk and then it would take me quite a while to settle back down again. But he kept doing this. And at a certain point, you know, it's like something shifted and I realized the reaction was extra, you know. And it was quite amazing actually to see that I could go from a really quiet, still space to what felt like a big disturbance, but just quiet, still, sitting alone, teacher, and this person is coming. I get up, I talk. Without the reactivity, there was very little disturbance in the mind. Then I just finished with that and then went back to sit. And it didn't take long to get reconnected in the same flow. So it's a little more challenging when your living situation, I mean, this was a, you know, people who would come every once in a while. It is more challenging when it's your whole living situation. However, it's the same process. You know, really seeing that the reactivity to it is the bigger problem than the situation. Right? So that becomes your practice. And it's a gradual one. You know, you get, okay, I can be okay with this much. And then it gets too much. But right there at that edge, can you relax even a little bit and just expand the comfort zone? So that's one aspect of the practice. I'll just say this again, because if you can remember this, it'll just be so helpful. It's the reactivity which is the real suffering, not the situation. So it's very analogous to, you know, you're sitting and there's a pain in the knee or a pain in the back. And at first, when people are first in the practice, oh, you know, I can't, this is too much. But as you know, you've all had the experience to some extent of discomfort arises in the body, and maybe at first there's the reaction, but then the mind settles. Okay, this is okay. It's unpleasant. It doesn't make it pleasant, but unpleasant is okay. And as soon as, or to the degree that we let go of the reactivity to the unpleasant, the mind is in a relatively peaceful place. So just keep in mind that it's the reactivity in the mind that's really the major cause of the suffering in a situation. Okay, all that having been said, the other component is when we're in a situation like that, then you might look, okay, is there a way, in some skillful way, to change the circumstances? You know, so it's not that we have to, I have to stay in this situation because it's good for my practice. You know, as long as you're in it, you want to use it as practice, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't perhaps explore other possibilities. So it's both of those.
I think time's up.
So we are at the end of our time together. And just to formally close our time on retreat, I wanted to take just a few moments to really contemplate together and to acknowledge all the work that we've done here, all the skillful efforts that we've put in over the course of these 9 days. So you might like to just take a few moments of silence. And if you can remember back that far, remember arriving into this room on opening night, coming into the hall for the first time and taking your seat. And you might get a sense from scrolling back that far just what a journey you've been on. You might get a sense of the highs and lows, the challenges and the rewards, and some of the many skillful qualities that have been strengthened through this process. And just taking a moment to really acknowledge those now, to let them in, to know your own wholesome efforts. To develop kindness, clarity, generosity, courage, compassion, openness, interest, ease, calm, balance, determination, equanimity. Just knowing or naming to yourself whatever feels true for you. In the strengthening of these skillful qualities of heart and mind. And in acknowledging these benefits that have come from your practice here over these 9 days, making the aspiration that whatever benefits have come from this time of practice, that they might be a contribution to the welfare, the happiness, and the freedom of all beings everywhere. May there be peace. On behalf of the whole team, thank you for your practice.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.